Welcome to the ADHD Alchemy Podcast, where women with ADHD finally feel seen, understood, and unapologetically themselves. If you have ever felt like you're too much and not enough all at the same time, you're in the right place because that's the alchemy, learning how both come together to make something priceless. I'm Jessica Covington, holistic ADHD coach and fellow fancy brain, and I'm really glad you're here. Let's get into it. Welcome to ADHD Alchemy. It's more than a podcast. It's also my signature coaching program at Fitology. It's perfect for bright, sensitive women who are tired of feeling scattered and chaotic and ready to feel calm, clear, and finally in control. Inside the program, whether it's group or private, we will quiet the relentless inner critic, break old patterns of self-sabotage, and begin redefining ADHD on your own terms. So in just a few weeks, you'll find yourself grounded, confident, and leading your life with intention by learning to work with your fancy brain instead of against it. If that speaks to you, find out more at fitology.com, and that will, of course, be in the show notes. Today, I am so excited to have with us Sarah Morgan, a licensed professional counselor specializing in maternal mental health, young adults, and life transitions. Based in Decatur, Georgia, she is certified in perinatal mental health and has expertise in working with neurodivergent teens and young adults. Everyone I refer to Sarah loves her warm, person-centered approach that emphasizes authenticity, collaboration, and emotional safety. Sarah integrates strength-based and mindfulness-informed practices to support individuals through the perinatal period and other pivotal life stages, which often lead to increased vulnerability and challenges during transitions. So Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So let's start with a little bit of clarity. You don't identify with ADHD yourself, but lots and lots of your clients do. And I think it can be really helpful to have a more neutral perspective on things sometimes. And the compassion you bring to your work makes that extra special. So I'd love for you to start out just letting us know, are you able to evaluate and diagnose? And how did neurodivergence develop as a special part of your practice?
Yes. And you're absolutely right. I do not identify or have an ADHD diagnosis. And I guess to kind of have more clarity around how my work has transformed, I can tell you about the start of my therapeutic journey as a licensed professional counselor. So I was fortunate enough to start my graduate school internship at a small nonprofit organization that primarily served teens and young adults who either had a autism spectrum disorder diagnoses, who had an ADHD diagnoses, or learned differently. And it was a really great entry point for me, as it allowed my education and my experience in my growth as a therapist to really learn to meet people exactly where they are, and to be able to, again, meet people where it's developmentally appropriate, without shame, without judgment. And so that is my humble beginnings as a therapist who is a neurotypical person, working with neurodivergent individuals. And so, again, like in the beginning, working from a compassion-based lens, meeting people where they are, gives a much broader space to work with somebody in, right? But, concretely, as I'm on that journey, I'm learning how to support people around executive functioning skills, strengthening them, identifying some of the skills that might not be as strong, and how this is impacting people daily or in transition journeys. So transitioning out of high school into college, similarly transitioning out of college into the real world. And And however that journey continues to go, changes and transitions can be difficult regardless of who you are. And so I was able, I think, to really show up in a way as a therapist that was that allowed me to work with people who, again, we identify differently, our brains work differently, but able to show up with no judgment, creating a really safe space to say, like, hey, this is who you are, and I'm here for it. And let's work together to figure out what works for you to be the best person, or for you to feel the most successful in your day-to-day life, how you interact with people, whatever it might be. When I had children and was in the postpartum period, I had this experience where I suddenly had this experience where I felt very parallel in the way my brain was working to somebody who would identify with ADHD. I could not focus. It was really hard to concentrate. I could not initiate all the things on my to-do list. I oftentimes felt really paralyzed. And so I share that just to say that experience was able to give me a really empathetic, well, a more empathetic experience to people with fancy brains.
You brought up two things that that really just struck a chord for me. One of those is meeting people where they are and just being here for it, as you said. That's all anybody really wants. They just want to be seen and accepted and loved for who they are. It always makes me cringe a little bit to use the phrase special needs when we're referring to people with ADHD or anything else, because needs aren't really that special. Our needs are the same as everybody else. We want to be seen, accepted, and loved. So I love that you bring that perspective to it. And to your last point about being in that transition from non-mom to mom, it's huge. And it is those kinds of transitions, non-parent to parent, career change, student to career person. Those kinds of transitions often can uncover ADHD that was hiding there all along, subclinically they call it.
Absolutely.
How can a normal, typical postpartum set of challenges mimic ADHD? And when does a woman need to look for a distinction?
Yes. So, when in postpartum, there are you're physiologically there are so many changes happening, and mom brain, so to speak, can often mimic executive functioning challenges because there is this drop in estrogen that happens. So again, similar to my experience, new moms might face that like inability to focus, like increased sensory overstimulation, whereas that might not have been such a sensitive experience before motherhood, like poor concentration, foggy brain. And these are, I think, some of the experiences that do mimic ADHD. Now, in postpartum, something that can be different is where we know that moms are not sleeping. There is sleep deprivation, that's impactful already like in this huge transition. So we're already not, our brain is not getting as much rest as before. There's also these experiences of postpartum anxiety or postpartum depression. And while that is different from ADHD, I think there's also some intersection around like increased irritability. Again, that like task paralysis in like just feeling unable to start a task when before this huge transition, that wasn't a challenge. I think where the intersection kind of drifts apart or becomes it's more this than it's more that is the postpartum brain eventually settles down. Now, that's not to say like it's a quick thing that happens. I mean, this can take a year or two. And I think that research shows now that the mom brain, so to speak, can take even further to kind of settle into its new identity. All that to say is, mom brain versus ADHD, you're going to see some improvement over the course of your hormones settling, improved sleep. You're going to be able to feel like I can manage this again. I think sometimes what, well, I will say, with many of the women I work with, something that can happen is that they have masked for so long that when this huge transition happens, they start realizing, oh, I've always kind of been, this has always been a challenge for me. Or starting a project has always been really hard for me, but I've had systems in place that have allowed me to finish the paint job on the wall or whatever it is. And now with this hormone change, sleep deprivation, like these are things that I can't, that don't feel like I'm, that just feel really different, but also familiar in a way. If that makes sense. For me, I was like, this is, I've never had a problem not focusing. I mean, like, sure, if like things, there's a lot going on or I'm high stressed, but when I, before pregnancy, when I put my to-do list down, my to-do list was getting done. It was just, there was a fluidity there. And now that I'm finding further out from postpartum, that postpartum period, that fluidity is back. And I think that can be a real distinction.
Yeah. So a woman, let's say in this example, who finds her world upended in the 3 to 6 months after giving birth, maybe shouldn't panic just yet. Give it a little more time before seeking a diagnosis or really trying to sort out that distinction.
Absolutely. I will say a caveat there is, you know, because there's so many hormone shifts, our bodies are changing after birth. If somebody is feeling off in the sense of like, okay, that paralyzed feeling, the irritability, I do encourage getting assessed for specific mood or anxiety that is in that period, right? So postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety, even OCD that can be onset during the postpartum period. I think that's always the place to start if things feel really off in after having a baby with an ADHD diagnosis or exploring like this, you know, this massive identity change. I think I would encourage, yeah, just a lot of compassion and grace that things feel different and a little bit more time. Does my brain feel, you know, I don't love this word, but more back to my normal, my like what's relative for me as I'm getting more sleep, as my hormones, yeah, are settling in some capacity.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So let's get into perinatal mental health. First, can you please explain what that even means in case there are folks who haven't heard that word? Then a bit more about what's happening with a woman's mental health and her nervous system and that hormonal balance you spoke of in this phase of life.
So perinatal mental health encompasses the pr pregnancy, conception, pregnancy through technically 2 years postpartum and just
Years.
everything in between. This is a time of, again, significant shifts in our biology, our physiology, and of course, like our brain. It's an incredibly vulnerable time. Often times, the information that we have of what happens during in pregnancy and in the postpartum period, I would say is really lacking. There's a really strong narrative about what pregnancy is, what it's supposed to feel like when you find out you're pregnant, when you've just had your baby and you fall in love and instantly. And perinatal mental health, I think, helps to broaden the perspectives of what actually falls under the umbrella of that period in time. And for many women, you know, statistically speaking, 50% of pregnancies are unplanned. There can be a lot of grief, in the experience, and certainly if there's any type of loss involved, or if you are pregnant and, you know, things are atypical on your journey, there can be excitement. There can be, you know, women, you know, oftentimes experience some form of morning sickness. You know, being really sick during pregnancy can increase depression. And so, perinatal mental health is just a really specialized, type of training that helps providers acknowledge and how to then support all these very complex issues that comes from pregnancy and postpartum. I will also say, because I think it's really important, and was is very connected to my own journey, people don't understand what's going to happen in what they call the fourth trimester.
Yeah,
I think
that is
you,
so true.
yeah, you know, I think people have this idea like I'm gonna be sleep deprived. Like your friends are like, just wait for it, you'll never sleep again. A very unhelpful comment. But I don't, I often find, again, personal experience and with the women I work with or the birthing people I work with, the level of shifting and change and what's happening to brain and body, mind and soul is so significantly different than any type of expectation that it can just really impact how we feel about ourselves, how we feel about this completely new identity and about our old identity that's just been shedded. And so again, perinatal mental health helps support people on that journey. And that includes dads as well. They're not, yeah, they're not free of being affected by or impacted by perinatal mood or anxiety disorders either.
Yeah, that's beautiful. There are so many layers to this. There's the identity shift for one, and I think, like you said, that is vastly underestimated. I'm not sure there are words enough in the English language to even describe it accurately. If you were talking directly to the person listening right now who is considering motherhood before she's approached it, what do you really want her to know about the specific ways that her self-concept might change?
I mean, generally speaking, I would be having a conversation that, hey, your self-concept does change. And then, you know, providing education. What happens in postpartum, there is a term, it's a newer term, it's called matrescence. And I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Essentially, this is like, the idea here is that it's sort of like what happens as when you go through puberty and you're in your teenager mode, right? Like your brain is again redeveloping, things are shifting. So the term mom brain, I would say, is actually there's scientific evidence that the gray matter in your brain decreases. And so people who experience mom brain, you know, might be forgetful or like forget a word mid-sentence. And what's happening is your gray matter is decreasing to make room to prune what you need to do to be able to keep a baby alive. This is like this completely natural biological experience. So all that to say is specifically providing education. Here's what could happen. And right, and again, just like everybody's people's fancy brains or our experience with anxiety or depression, the pregnancy and postpartum experience is so unique. But I think, yeah, in supporting women and their self-concept, really, really providing education and space to say, one, it's okay if you don't feel the way the narrative says you should feel.
Yes.
And there's no shame in that. And let's process that together, because it's fair and it's valid. I would say I would also set people up around the education about what happens in your partnership. Some people feel really differently after they have a baby, towards their partner. And again, educating around here's why some of that might be happening, right? Your hormones are going crazy. You don't have any sleep. Your roles have changed. There's now a new dynamic. And again, you become what is the most natural thing in the world, a mother, and your biological instinct and focus goes to keeping that baby alive, keeping it safe, nurturing it. And so I just, yeah, providing education and the space to explore what happens in this season that can be so raw and that can be bring such vulnerability.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and really, really important. And I love the way that you left space in what you were saying for all of those experiences to be different. There's no one size fits all when it comes to how things change in motherhood. And that there's probably no better tie-in than ADHD. In that idea that one size never fits all. So going back to those layers of mental health, we talked about the identity piece. There's also, I think, the realization that what used to help us cope is just not cutting it anymore. ADHD or not, the things that used to work for us might or might not work anymore. So many women, like we were saying earlier, fly under the radar with ADHD until they're in their 30s or they have young kids, and suddenly they don't even recognize their own minds anymore. ADHD often goes along with being really bright, and the smarter we are, the better we can mask our struggles. And then there's also this socialization piece, all the messages about being good girls and good students. It's really no wonder that midlife diagnosis is on the rise. When somebody gets diagnosed in midlife, based on what you've seen in your clients, what tends to break first? Is it her coping strategies, her identity, her relationships, or something else?
That's such a good question. And I've seen like the gambit of it, right? I will say more often than not, what I have experienced with my clients in particular is they're coming in because they're burnt out. Just they can't, they're fatigued constantly. They can't sleep well. They don't feel connected to their body anymore. They don't know how to rest, or they've never learned how to rest. I see a lot of women who come in and are like, I'm burnt out, but I'm the only person who can do this role at my job, in my home, in this family. And if my day, or they'll say, if my day isn't as productive as this, nothing will get done. And so for me, that burnout piece is really, really a big piece of this puzzle. From there, it can kind of trans like kind of transcend like to in many directions. So identifying, okay, there's burnout here. What's happening in your body? What's happening in your brain? And I've worked with women who are like, oh, okay, I've now been exploring what ADHD is and have these aha moments. Okay, well, that's what it was like, or why I was like this when I was a teenager, or why I was like this when I was in college. And that identification can feel so empowering. It finally all makes sense, right? On the other end of that spectrum, I have women who have had a diagnosis from a really early age and again are on this burnout journey and have such, who have created and have had a narrative created for themselves that they are less than because their brains work so differently. And then it just makes it all the more hard for everything. And the things that go wrong in their home or the to-do list, they're never getting it done, but they can't stop. So circling back, the burnout piece is oftentimes what, in my practice, what a lot of women come in for, and then either having identified or already having a diagnosis and what their narrative has become about their self-concept, what their core beliefs are about themselves. Or again, that aha moment where it's like, oh, okay, my brain, this makes so much sense now. I realize, and then shifting one, their own systems, but shifting two, how they respond to the systems that have been in play their whole lives. So it's really interesting, all the various journeys. But again, that thread piece or that one thread of, I'm here because I'm burnout. I'm here because being a mom is hard. And I don't know what else to do. Like I have nothing left in the tank.
It's sad that people sometimes reach that point where they have no idea what to do, where to turn, nothing left in the tank before they seek out help. But thankfully, they do. So when somebody has masked for decades, constantly self-monitoring, overcorrecting, performing competence, this is kind of an off-the-wall question, but do you think that creates something like a low-grade trauma response?
I absolutely do, right? And if we're looking at the nervous system, there's this internalized self-correction that's happening for years and years and years, which, I would put very parallelly to staying in a state of fight or flight. Or even, the opposite of that is being in that frozen space. That our nervous system can do, the hypoarousal. When we have small, like when we have trauma responses, again, our bodies respond in a way that is activated. And whether that's activation in shutdown or activation in that fight or flight, that up kind of activation, that's what's happening in the trauma. So yeah, I think there's that is an experience. And certainly I would say, again, going back to this idea of, I think you mentioned at first, the type of systems that just don't work anymore. And the type of narratives that people have held their whole lives. I mean, I remember being in elementary school and I don't even know that, ADHD, ADD was a term used, similar to like millennials and anxiety, right? Like every millennial in high school had anxiety, but nobody knew what it was. And now we do. But I remember like there was a kid in my classes who had to take, like, I think it was Ritalin throughout. The narrative there was this kid is bad. This kid doesn't behave. These very simplistic statements, but it's a repeated narrative. If I heard I was bad my whole life, I don't think I could stay in a regulated state. Or if I was to get dysregulated, I don't know that it would be really challenging to come back down to being more regulated, being in that safe space in our bodies. And then looking at our systems, and certainly I think we can say in this day and age that the systems are not set up to support women in ways that are most beneficial in the complexity of our own identities over the course of our lifetime.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, sticking with this idea of decades of masking, what do you see happening with a woman's relationship to desire? And here I'm talking about desire as in drive and ambition and knowing what I want and going after it, not necessarily sexual desire.
Sure.
What do you see happen to her ability to know what she wants and to claim it? And how does therapy then begin to improve that for her?
Yeah. So when people are masking, what I have observed can happen is that there is a lot of energy being used to sort of self-correct. I'll use the term you said, right? Like to not speak out or yell out during class, to not change the subject very quickly, to be able to focus on, let's say if it's an adult, like be able to focus on this one project at work and not like hop around to several different things and then nothing's getting done. And so I think we can think of it in terms of there's a lot of energy going into, there's a lot of internalized dialogue, there's a lot of mental and cognitive energy that is taking up all this space just to do it the way they should be doing it, or the way that the system is set up to be done. In therapy, as people can process out or even identify, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And let me give this example. I have a student I'm working with who just recently started on medication. And because they now have a little bit of breathing room, they're not working so hard to manage anxiety or manage what I'm saying in this group setting or in that group setting. They have more space to reflect, to find the language to what their experiences have been and reflect about that. When we can open up the space, which therapy, a part of therapy is just that, right? Like opening up the space, exploring, reflecting, saying out loud the things that we don't often say or that we've never said. All that energy gets released, and then people can start to focus on the things that matter to them the most. So I'm done being burnt out. Like I recognize I'm doing this because my brain is, I have an ADHD diagnosis. Like this makes so much sense. And because I'm not masking all the time, because I'm showing up as my authentic self in the way my brain works, now I have space, energy, time, motivation to work towards these new goals or to create or curate the life or the job or the hobby that I really want to be putting my time and effort in. I think
Wow.
therapy really can help unlock one, just the dialogue around it, but two, that reflection piece in the processing. What was it like then? What is it like now? How does it feel to show up as yourself? How do you do that? And then what is going to work the very best for you moving forward? Because, and I don't know, Jessica, you can maybe speak to this, but I feel like once people identify that they're masking and really put in the self work to shift that, oh gosh, what am I saying? That they don't want to go back because
Yeah.
the way before felt unnatural. It felt kind of maybe like swimming upstream oftentimes. And so then they began working more fluidly. And this is the way I want my life to be. And this is how I'm going to set it up now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautifully said. And I think too, at least this has been my experience in therapy. Even if medication is not a part of the picture, the space that you mentioned creating in therapy and being with somebody who accepts, who sees and understands and accepts me the way I am is, for me, that was a huge part of being able to name and claim what it is that I really want. Because before that, I had felt like I didn't have any right or reason or entitlement, I guess, to even want things because I was so busy trying to be all the things to all the people. And therapy gave me the space to step back and say, well, okay, there is that idea of being all the things to all the people, and I get to be a person too.
Absolutely. And I want to piggyback off of the medication thing. And, you know, that is one of these complex decisions that, you know, everybody has a complex perspective on that or has their own perspective, and that's fine. I think therapy can also offer, sort of just like what you were saying, right? A space to learn how to be self-compassionate, to learn to give yourself grace, to start reflecting and retelling these narratives or exposing this internalized dialogue that people have lived with their whole life that just isn't reality. Therapy can help us reframe, reshift the core beliefs, the things we most deeply believe about ourselves. And I think really importantly, and I think we've talked about this before, utilizing language, verbalizing your experience lessens the amount of shame that we carry with ourselves. And when we feel like we don't fit, oftentimes that narrative is, I'm doing something wrong. There's something wrong with me. I'm not doing it right. I don't know how to do it right. And there's so much shame attached to that. And I think that space where you can just start saying the things that you've been holding in that don't feel good, it just helps that shame, that block of shame that we sometimes have, just disintegrate.
Yes. I love that you said that because that's the whole reason we're here. That's the reason for being for this podcast is to be able to hear other people say those things that we've kept inside. Maybe it allows us a little space to say them as well and release that shame. What are your thoughts on the relationship of therapy to coaching? How do you see them as similar or different, and how can a woman know where to start?
Such a great question. I think I've said that after every question because these are really great thought-provoking questions, and these are conversations
Thank
that need
you.
to be had. My personal and professional take is that I do think that therapy and coaching are very similar. I mean, I know there are some significant differences. When I think about coaching, I sort of also think about parallelly like executive function coaching, right? Like there are some specific concrete goals that you're working towards. And it's not to say that that experience is void of processing your emotional experience or your like cognitive and mental health experience. But I do think the coaching space allows for the action oriented, here's step A, and here's how we're breaking it down. And I think you can quantify goals in that way. I don't know if that even makes sense. It's just there's a concreteness there, which I think is amazing, and I actually think is really helpful. I think, you know, if you're looking at therapy as what's the difference there, that the therapy space is going to encompass more of that processing, exploring the emotional piece and connecting brain and body. And while certainly some therapies and some therapists work well with really structured goal setting type of sessions, that space, I think the front runner of the therapy space is going to be working out what's happening with me emotionally or what's happening with me mentally and processing this and deep reflection, versus let's set this goal let's change these systems. And I think they can marry really well.
Yeah. If I had a magic wand, I would make both therapy and coaching available to every person in the world. I think they're both just
Absolutely.
so beneficial and complementary.
Yes, absolutely. I oftentimes, I'm not, I don't have training in coaching. I don't have a coaching certificate, but I oftentimes, again, working in executive functioning, get to do a blend of both in some sort. And I will say it's really interesting because I'm a therapist, and that is the ultimate lean, that is the way my sessions take, it ends up becoming the process oriented, let's explore, what happened to me this week, or and this is why that's impacting me. Even though there are sometimes where, yeah, we can do both, but in my therapeutic profession, in my practice, it tends to lean more towards that therapy side.
Yeah, of course. So, as we wrap up here, Sarah, if the woman listening to this takes away only one important message from all the beautiful tangents we've been on, what do you want her to know 100% deep in her bones about ADHD or anything else?
Yeah, I think I would want a listener to know that there isn't, we as women don't have anything wrong with us. We are, again, on this, over the course of our lifespan, we have so many changes that are, specific to being women. And I think we discussed, this, what that ADHD can look really different in women, and that sometimes, like, the systems that are supposed to support us totally miss it. Similarly, this huge transitional experience when you are on your on a pregnancy and a postpartum journey, that identity shift. And I think what I would really want anybody to listening to know is that there's no right or wrong in our authentic selves. And that sometimes we get blocked in knowing how to move forward because of the narratives and the systems that can be at play, especially as a woman in this world. You get to decide at any time that things don't work for you or that you need support, and you should be met with understanding and non-judgment and celebration of this is, whether you're showing up and saying, this is hard for me, I don't know who I am anymore, or this is hard for me, my brain is different from the people that I work with or that I'm in school with. And you should be met with, yeah, safety and compassion and understanding, no matter what season of life you're in. And yeah, I think creating space for these types of vulnerability and learning more about what it is to be a woman, it's just so empowering. And I think oftentimes as women, we are taught everybody else comes first.
Oh, yeah.
We take care of people, we're caretakers. And in reality, we are more prone to nurturing and empathy and all that, but we are allowed to take up space. And sometimes we need support to take up space, and that support is there. Sometimes it just takes some bravery and some courage and some, burnout to call it, like, this doesn't work for me anymore, and I don't accept this anymore. And there are people who are ready to meet you in that space.
Beautiful. Sarah, thank you so much for being here and sharing all of this wisdom and compassion. I'm personally so grateful to have known you for years and for the work you're doing to support women who feel like they've lost something along the way and who need a guide on the way to becoming this fuller version of themselves. So, for folks who want to learn more about you and your work, how can they find you?
You can go to my website. It's super simple. It's Sarah, Sarah K. Morgan, LPC.com. I do have a Facebook and Instagram page, though I am not great about keeping up with social media, though I try my hardest. But on my website, everything is there. My contact, my phone contact information, my email, and all the information about my socials that I more often than not, despite really wanting to leave unattended for very long periods of time. Though that is a new goal for me this year to, spread the knowledge and just spread what it is to be a woman and all the experiences in between, over social media to widen, the accessibility and for people to just say like, oh yeah, I get that. I get that. And I'm not alone.
Exactly. Thank you again, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you,
Always good to talk to
Jessica.
you.
Yeah, fabulous. This was so great. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Time for your ADHD Alchemy Lab Kit. Three ideas from this episode that you can try in your own life. Number one, take a burnout inventory. Ask yourself, am I tired because I'm busy, because I'm not getting enough sleep, or I'm getting low quality sleep? Or because I'm physically exhausted from working out or too much physical activity that's not getting enough recovery time, or because I'm masking. Notice where you are self-monitoring, self-correcting, overcompensating internally all day long. And know that this is draining. It's exhausting work, and it's data to help you sort out exhaustion from burnout. Number two, rewrite one old narrative. So finish this sentence. I've always believed I'm bad at blank, and fill in the blank. Now ask, is that actually objectively true, or was that a story built in a system that didn't fit me? And just sit with the difference for a while and see what shakes out. And number three, educate before you evaluate. So, if you're in pregnancy or the postpartum period, which remember can last up to 2 years, and you're feeling scattered, foggy, or irritable, learn about matrescence and hormonal shifts before judging yourself. Information can soften shame. That's your ADHD Alchemy Lab Kit. I hope you will pick one experiment and let me know how it goes. Thanks for listening to the ADHD Alchemy podcast. If you're nodding along and thinking, oh yeah, that's me, then please subscribe and share this episode with another woman who gets it. Your reviews help more women discover they're not failing. They're just wired differently. And that is a good thing, despite the challenges. Plus, I want to hear your story. Apply to be a guest at myadhdalchemy.com and join my free community at fitology.com/community. Those links will be in the show notes. Together, we can rewrite the ADHD shame story into one of strength. I'll see you next time.